Hello, and welcome to Mother Daughter Earthcast, a show that will help you navigate the eco world and live a more colorful and conscious life. We'll inform, inspire, and embolden you.
And most importantly, we'll have fun along the way to a more planet-caring lifestyle together.
But they're going to fly all the way from Canada down to Mexico, where they have never been.
Wow.
And they're going to know where to go. We should be fairly worried, but there are steps we can take, and I'll talk about that. The big problem is loss of habitat, as is true of so many wild animals.
Welcome back to Mother Daughter Earthcast. This is Mariana Archibald.
And I'm Jenna Woods.
So, full disclosure, we usually try to be super positive in our podcast episodes, and this one does have a positive spin. But if you have a soft spot for monarchs and butterflies and wildlife in general, then just buckle your seatbelt, because we talk about monarchs and we learned so much from Janet Smith in this episode and in our conversation with her. But a big part of that is learning about how the monarch population is declining, if not collapsing, and has been in the last few years. So off the bat, just wanted to give you all that disclosure.
But Janet also tells us what we can do and how we can help the monarchs. And we can all do something to help increase the population of monarchs. It's critical now.
It is. Okay, so Mom, I thought I knew about monarchs, but I would love to hear your reaction from our conversation with Janet. She like freaking painted a picture of exactly everything that happens in a monarch life, and I feel just like so much more in awe of them now. I was already in awe of them because they fly such long distances, but everything, every single stage that Janet just like paints for us was amazing.
It was, wasn't it? And she does it in such a simple way that everyone can understand it.
And I love how humble she is when she describes herself as the Monarch 101 teacher, because she makes it seem like she, you know, she says like, I'm not the expert or whatnot. Oh my gosh, she is such a wealth of knowledge and is so great at just sharing the message of monarchs and sharing her love. It was great.
Yes, her love and passion.
And passion.
And Janet is such a great speaker. She is on the Speakers Bureau, the Dallas County Master Gardeners, and she is one of the most requested speakers.
I can see why. She had us in stitches. Like, here we are, you know, crying about monarch population collapse, yet laughing because she's just such, she's such a big personality. She was great. Mom, yet another great find. Way to go. Your plant friends are really fun.
We're pretty cool.
Yeah, you are pretty cool. And Janet, y'all will hear this on the podcast too, even has a monarch tattoo.
She does.
And she, you guys, what you should do is head over to YouTube and keep an eye out for this video. And when you see Janet, you don't necessarily automatically think tattoo. Let's just put it that way.
Nope.
She has many surprises up her sleeve. Janet does.
She does.
And our bonus episode with her was super fun. We kind of go a little bit more in depth into monarchs and how everyone can be a citizen scientist. Listen, as a scientist myself, I do love that idea, but it's basically everyone can contribute to the research that's needed to track and you know, track these monarchs. So, man, Janet, you're amazing. Wealth of knowledge. We just loved learning from Janet.
Yeah, I always enjoy whenever I get to hear her speak. I always learn so much and have a great time.
So yeah, there's not much else to report here, to be honest. So before we head over to Janet, if you guys can please, as always, pause this, rate and review us on iTunes and Apple Podcasts, that would really help. And head over to patreon.com/mother-daughter-earth to check out all of the bonus episodes and courses that we're uploading. It's always happening over there. So without further ado, please welcome Janet Smith, the monarch enthusiast, to Mother Daughter Earthcast.
This is going to be fun. Okay, Janet, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. We are so lucky today to have one of my friends, Janet Smith, with us. And Janet, she's a Dallas County Master Gardener. She's on the Speakers Bureau there. She's a North Texas Master Naturalist. She's also one of the main leaders of the Dallas County Native Plant Society. And she loves monarch butterflies. In fact, maybe a little known fact, Janet even has a monarch butterfly tattooed on her shoulder. So welcome to the podcast, Janet. We're so happy you're here with us.
Well, thank you so much, Jana, and it's a thrill to be here.
Well, before we started recording, I actually had to stop the conversation because Janet was already giving us all these awesome stories and pieces of nuggets of wisdom. So, Janet, can you tell our community and audience how you got into loving monarchs and how you were exposed to the monarch world? And since you're now obviously a huge fan and like educating people about them, I'd love to hear a little bit about what sparked that passion.
Well, I've always liked butterflies, and I moved into my house in 1977. I still live here. And I decorated my bedroom in butterfly stuff. So this is, you know, a long time that I have liked butterflies. But I didn't know squat about butterflies. I probably didn't even know they were insects. You know, they weren't anything I gave any thought to. And just along the way, I got more interested in them when I became a master gardener after a lifetime of knowing nothing about gardening. Not even to water plants when you put them in the ground. I mean, you know, you couldn't be much dumber than I was. Although I've heard a couple stories. But you know, and I started hearing about the monarchs, and I thought every orange butterfly was a monarch. Well, it turns out there's a lot of other orange butterflies. And I came to realize a lot of people were at that level where if it was an orange butterfly, it had to be a monarch. And so I can relate to being that person. So my speaking, I always call myself a 101 level speaker because I'm for the entry level. I'm not an expert. I don't have formal education in this. In fact, I avoided science in high school and in college. So I never took it till I was a senior to fulfill my requirement because although I'm an optimist, if I was going to die, I didn't want to waste any time in a science class. You know, that wasn't my interest. And now I'm just eating it up. But it all started, you know, when I was 60. So I'm late to the party. But when I really learned about monarchs was I'd heard about their overwintering site in Mexico. And I wanted to go. And I had a friend from my master gardener class, Francis Gonzalez, who had taken some trips to Mexico and knew an organizer of trips, and she got her to plan a trip to go specifically to see the monarchs while they were there. And we went in February of 2007. And then I started researching a lot more about monarchs and became much more knowledgeable after I had seen them. So,
well, can you tell us about where your experience in Mexico, seeing where the monarchs overwinter, and you might even address maybe even the life cycle. I mean, what is the life cycle of them? And anyway, just tell us a little bit about the monarchs down in Mexico and how they get there. Well, they obviously fly.
Yes, they do fly. That is their means of transportation.
Thank you, Mom.
Unlike us, that went on a big bus. But the monarchs are a part of the Lepidopterous family of insects. And that class, that family, is moths and butterflies. And they all go through a metamorphosis. The female lays an egg. And in the case of the monarch, that the egg lives for a week or two. It's all dependent on the temperature. The warmer it is, the faster the process goes. But there's an egg, and then the monarch egg is about the size of a dot you'd make with a pen or pencil. Mm. It's very small. And then after a week or two, comes out this tiny little caterpillar that is about the size of the amount of lead you would have out on a mechanical pencil. Hmm. So maybe a 16th of an inch. But okay. It's been in this tiny little thing that's about the size of sea salt or kosher salt.
Okay.
That size.
That's small.
And it's tiny. And this tiny little caterpillar comes out that, frankly, you're probably not ever going to see with your naked eye. And the first thing the caterpillar does is eat its egg casing, the shell of the egg, okay. because that's protein.
Mm.
And then it's going to eat the plant that it's on. And monarchs only, the caterpillars of monarchs eat only plants in the milkweed family. So the female monarchs are always searching for milkweed to lay their eggs on.
Mm-hmm.
And milkweed has a toxin in it. And as the caterpillar ingests it, it makes itself unpalatable to all the animals with backbones. And birds are a huge consumer of caterpillars. But birds will only eat one monarch caterpillar because it makes them throw up.
Nice.
And like us, if we eat something and we throw up a few minutes later, we're probably not going to go back for a second bite. And that's one of the ways monarchs protect themselves. So they're a caterpillar, again, for about 2 weeks. And during that time, it's the equivalent growth of a human newborn to the size of a gray whale.
Whoa.
Because that thing that hatches out, you know, at about a 16th of an inch, gets to be about as big as your little finger in about 2 weeks.
Wow.
And it eats, first it eats its eggshell, then it eats the tiny little hairs on the underneath side of the milkweed leaf, because the mother laid the eggs on the underneath side to protect them. And we can't feel those hairs or see them, but they're size appropriate for this tiny caterpillar. And when it's about a week old is when we would start noticing it with the naked eye. But it's going to chomp down on that plant and eat away for 2 weeks. It's going to outgrow its skin 4 or 5 times.
Wow.
And it has to, then it will glue itself to the leaf or the stem, wherever it happens to be. And it takes about 12 hours for the caterpillar to grow another skin underneath the one it has. Then it will crawl out of its own old skin, which is glued to the leaf, and it'll turn around and eat that skin as more protein.
What?
Then it'll go on eating the leaves. The fifth time that it's filled up its skin is when it's going to crawl off and go to its next life stage, which is a chrysalis. And a lot of people, now I can't think of the term, forget that. It'll be a chrysalis again for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, perhaps, depending on the weather. And then the butterfly will emerge. But when it goes off to find a place to pupate, it's called, to form its chrysalis, it's just going to start crawling. And when it hits something that's vertical, it will climb up it hoping to find something that's vertical, and it'll climb out on that because it wants to hang to become a chrysalis. And it will hang itself, it will glue itself, usually to a stem or underneath your picnic table or underneath a railing top or the eaves of your house. It could be anywhere. You know, that that horizontal board on your fence, just whatever they encounter. And it's going to glue itself there and hang in what's called the J position. And again, this is about 12 to 24 hours. And then it's going to start moving around and its skin is going to tear apart, sort of like the Incredible Hulk. Uh-huh. You know? And it will, it's like it has a zipper and it opens up. And then this, now it's a pupa or a chrysalis, and it kind of twists its body around to get rid of that skin because it doesn't want anything touching it. Because anything touching it could make it be deformed.
Mm.
And, of course, it wants to be healthy. So it doesn't want anything touching it. And one day, I got to watch that four times.
Wow.
And
my
the
God.
Fourth time, it dawned on me, take a video. Because I was always a still photographer, and all my videos were, oh, blankety blank, how do I turn this off? You know? And I got a really nice video of that. And I show it in my PowerPoints, but it's just real interesting to watch. And it's like an emerald green or a light emerald. It's the color of a leaf. So if it's in hanging on a plant, you won't see it because it's going to blend in. Mm. And that's another part of its protection.
And it has little gold dots on it, doesn't it?
Yes, it has little gold dots around the top and in a predictable pattern on the rest of it. And that's one of the theories about how it got its name Monarch, because it looks like a crown.
Mm.
There's several theories, but that's one of them. And about 12 hours before the butterfly is going to emerge, you can see the butterfly wings in the casing of the chrysalis. So you know it's about to happen. And most often, the butterfly will emerge in the morning. So it has the daylight to help it warm up and help its wings set. But it has to come out of that skin very quickly. And if it stalls, the butterfly won't survive. Mm. You know, it's like blink twice and it's out. So wow. You're very lucky if you actually get to see it emerge because, you know, you could easily miss it.
Okay.
You sneeze or something, you missed it. And then the butterfly sits there for a while and just lets gravity have its wings uncurl, kind of unfurl. It's all wrinkled. It's kind of like having stuff in a silk scarf like Mariana's wearing into one of those old film canisters.
Mm.
And if you're old enough, you'll remember what a film canister is. Young folks don't know what we're talking about.
I remember.
Yeah. She even took photography classes and learned how to develop film the old-fashioned way.
I did.
Yeah, I did too. But anyway, it's all wrinkled and it wants those wrinkles to hang out. Then, and its body is much bigger than its wings. Then it pulls the liquid out of its body and pumps it through its wings to extend them to their whole size.
What?
And that's as big as the wings will ever get. The wings never grow after that. Mm-hmm. Whatever they hatch out with, that's the size of their wings. And then it draws back the excess fluid, which is called mercurium, and it drops it. It pees. And that liquid is kind of pinkish.
Hmm.
So people think the monarch is bleeding, but it's not. It's just the color of that fluid, that excess fluid that it's releasing. Then it'll just sit there with its wings expanded, and it might every once in a while flap. But during this time, it's also knitting together its proboscis, and that's what it drinks with. And it starts out in two pieces and it kind of has to knit it together. And so it's blowing its proboscis, it's uncurling it and bringing it back. And it's real interesting to watch if you know that's happening, but if it's easy to miss because people don't look at it because they're so mesmerized by the wings, yeah, which at this point are doing nothing. But eventually it gets that proboscis all knit together. Then it'll really start flapping its wings and getting its muscles going and eventually take its first flight, which may or may not go very far. They might just fall to whatever's below them, the ground or another leaf or a table or whatever happens to be below them. And then they kind of regroup for a few minutes and then they fly off. And they don't eat for the first 24 hours or so.
Oh, wow.
And then the monarchs that hatch out in the spring and the summer live an average of 2 weeks. They could live as long as 6 weeks, but the ones that hatch out starting in the end of August, those ones will be four generations removed from the ones that came from Mexico. And it's that generation that flies back to Mexico. So here you have these little, well, butterflies. They're fairly big for a butterfly. They have a 3 to 4 inch wingspan usually. But they're going to fly all the way from Canada down to Mexico where they have never been.
Wow.
And they're going to know where to go. And during that time, they're going to be eating machines to build up their bodies. Their wings aren't going to grow because they have to get enough food to last through the winter. And they kind of go in to not really hibernation, but go into a low energy state to get through the winter. And then when the plants start blooming again and growing, then they head north. And typically the ones that migrated will be laying their eggs in Mexico or Texas. They might get a little further north, but then they die. And then their offspring start when they hatch out, will fly further north. And it takes usually four. Some years we get five generations.
Wow.
Amazing. So. Wow. And well, and do they eat anything other than milkweed during their lifespan, or it's only milkweed? Yes.
No, the only stage that eats milkweed is the caterpillar.
Okay.
The adult butterfly drinks nectar.
Okay.
And they might drink nectar from milkweed because milkweed produce a lot of nectar and they feed a lot of insects and hummingbirds. But they'll eat nectar, drink nectar from any plants. I mean, there's a wide variety. Not every plant produces nectar, but there's a wide variety of them. And there are a couple that are really, people are encouraged to grow for the migration south. And those are Greg's Blue Mist Flower,
mm-hmm,
and Frostweed.
Yes.
So,
because those are very beneficial to the monarchs and they love them, and they'll, your plants will be full of monarchs and other pollinators.
We love seeing the monarchs. And on that note, my mom and I were chatting before we started talking with you, Janet, and we were just saying how, to be honest, most, if not all of our podcast episodes up until now have been really positive, but we were going through just some of the information that we have on the migration or the monarch population collapse or decline. And we looked at each other, mom almost started crying. Mm-hmm. And we just said, how are we going to keep this one positive? And we just decided, you know what? We want to give people the information. And at the end, you know, obviously after we talk about what's happening with the monarch population, we of course want to leave people with tangible things that they can do to help. But can you please talk us through really what's happening with the monarch population. I know there's an Eastern and a Western migration, and the numbers kind of vary between the two. What have we seen in recent years, and how worried should we be?
We should be fairly worried, but there are steps we can take, and I'll talk about that.
Good.
But the big problem is loss of habitat.
Mm-hmm.
As is true of so many wild animals, because as our human population has grown and develops more and more of what once was a wild area, there's less and less habitat for most animals, including insects. And frankly, you know, you look at a place like Dallas-Fort Worth, and I've lived here since 1960, and it's grown exponentially. And as far as nectar-drinking animals, be they insects or hummingbirds, you know, grass is useless.
Mm-hmm.
What we use as our turf grass, our lawns,
mm-hmm.
offer nothing. Concrete, of course, offers nothing. Buildings offer nothing. And so there's just a total lack of places for them to find the food they need, both for their caterpillars and as adults. And so they're, and out in the country, in the agricultural areas, with the advent of Roundup as a weed killer, that has taken a huge, an area equal to the size of Texas has been taken out of the farm belt because there used to be milkweed growing among the crops, say the corn or the soybeans. And now there's no milkweed in those fields. And whereas fields used to have a border around them, now they're planted right up to the roads. And another problem is that highway departments got the idea that growth right along the sides of roads, and I'm not talking super highways, but blacktop roads,
mm-hmm.
you know, was detrimental to the drivers. So they started mowing along all those edges. And that was another area where milkweed flourished. And so it was destroyed. So there's been a lot of inadvertent and planned destruction of milkweed. So that has really affected the monarchs. Now there's, and all the nectar plants as well, because we don't have as much wild area as we used to. We try to control everything now. But in the last 5 years especially, there has been a huge movement among highway departments like TxDOT and others to replant milkweed along the roadways.
Great.
And in lots of states now, that's being done regularly. And monarchs have become the poster child for pollinators, because anything that a monarch uses, all the other pollinators like bees, which are another type of insect that is so important to our survival because it pollinates so much of our food. Butterflies are wonderful and they're beautiful, but they don't usually have a positive monetary impact. You know, nobody's making money off of anything monarchs do, except perhaps from tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And so traditionally, there's not much research done on monarchs because nobody's willing to pay for it, because nobody's going to get rich off of finding out the best way to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the monarchs are very colorful. Lots of states have them as their state butterfly, including Texas. And so they've been a good poster child for the pollinator movement.
Well, you were mentioning that the highway departments are planting milkweed seed. Have they stopped mowing? I mean, every time.
Oh, yes.
Good.
Yes, they've stopped mowing too. Yeah, they have a much more planned mowing scene at the correct time to encourage the growth of milkweeds and other pollinator plants.
Good, because that always enrages me whenever I see them mowing next to the highways, because they're killing, or they're cutting down so many of the native plants, and I always think of the milkweed and so many other beneficial plants for pollinators, and I'm glad to hear that they're starting to get the memo about that.
Yes, and
yeah, you know, it's kind of like we're phased through the better living through chemistry era that I remember so well as a child, when Dow Chemical was such a major advertiser on TV. You know, you asked me what was TV in the 50s and the early 60s, and I'll say Better Living Through Chemistry sponsored it. I know there were lots of other sponsors, but for some reason, you know, that's what sticks in my mind. And then I had no idea what they were talking about. But now that we do, there has been a huge movement to cut back on the use of chemicals and mowers.
Well, can you tell us what's going on with the eastern and western monarch population?
Okay. And for the purpose of the monarchs, they're considered eastern if they're east of the Rocky Mountains.
Okay.
Which to many people that the Rockies are in the west. But for the monarchs, everything east of the Rockies is east. And the western population is in California, mostly along the Pacific coast is where it spends its winters.
Okay.
And that population is now 10% of what it was about 20 years ago.
Oh.
And again, development. We know how much we've grown here. They've grown that much there too. And the monarchs east of the Rockies fly down to Mexico for the winter. The ones west of the Rockies were going to forested regions along the coast where there was eucalyptus and Monterey pines, where they're big, the trees that they would mass up in. And there were predictable spots where that happened. And now the people that track this, and they have like a Thanksgiving monarch count, they're having to go to more and more and more spots and finding fewer and fewer butterflies. Mm. But in 2007, when I went to Mexico, and it turned out that was a good year. Okay. And we've never gotten that good since then. And by good, I mean a high count of butterflies.
Okay.
You know, we saw millions of butterflies and, you know, way too many to count. And the way they put a number to them was how many hectares, which is about equal to 2 acres, how many hectares were covered with monarchs that they could see when they flew over that area. And that's how they measured it roughly. So in 2011, I went to Pacific Grove, California, which is right next to Monterey, because that was one of their big overwintering sites traditionally. And I went with my friend, Francis Gonzalez, with whom I'd gone to Mexico. And we went out, you know, we arrived one night, we went out the next morning to where we knew they would be. And there was only one person there kind of sweeping up. It was behind one of those 50s era motels with little cabins. You know, and so you just drove up and parked in the parking lot. There they were. You know, not like in Mexico where you had to go to great lengths and different transportation methods and climb way up in the mountains to see them. They were very accessible. And so we were talking to it turned out it was a man, and he said, "Oh yeah, we've got a lot this year. We've counted 10,000. And Francis and I looked at each other and said, "We came to California for 10,000 when we've seen millions?" You know, but he said, you can see him in the afternoon. He says, "Come back about 2 o'clock and then you'll see them." And we went and did other things and came back at 2 o'clock and we saw him, and there was other people there watching them as well. But it was, you know, that was a good indication of the difference between the number that goes to Mexico and the number that's in California. And it turned out that year that was not the most populous site for the monarchs. It was Pismo Beach had more of them. But
and I heard that the count this year was 1,914 monarchs sighted
in California.
Yeah, it's just so sad at how the numbers have dropped off so sharply just in the last couple of years. I mean, they were always dwindling, but, you know, like last year was a big wake up call. And then this year was, oh my God, you know, are we, maybe they'll be wiped out. And the monarchs were added to the list to be designated as an endangered species. But after takes 3 years of study and everything, I think it is, it takes several years.
Okay.
And the end result was they were not classified as endangered.
Why?
Well, there was several reasons, but one of them was that people were already aware and taking measures to help them, their population increase.
Well, God forbid we took more measures.
Yeah. Well, evidently, you know, we can only do a certain number. It's all in the money.
Yeah.
And everything. But it didn't mean that they couldn't be declared an endangered species again in a few years.
Well,
but it's, you know, they are in danger. And that's like when you say going to Mexico to see the overwintering site is on your bucket list. I'm saying
go.
You need to plan it for next year. It's they've left Mexico now.
Right.
And because each, and frankly, the next year, the numbers overwintering down there are probably not going to be huge because of the big freeze we had in Texas last month.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because my mom has seen one monarch so far. I've seen two, and we both have very pollinator friendly yards, and we typically see a lot more than that. And we were both talking about the freeze. We also had that massive tornado. It was a year and a half ago. Well, my mom can tell you more, but we were in her yard the day before the tornado and there it was teeming with monarchs. And then for some reason, the day after the tornado, we saw none.
And then the rest of the season,
we didn't see any. And I digress. But yes, we personally have noticed a huge drop. Well, we were on the phone like, have you seen monarchs? Like, I haven't seen any.
I know.
That's interesting because I haven't heard anybody relay a story like that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe because there was so many other life-threatening issues about that tornado.
Yeah. No,
yeah,
they did not come back that whole season. And I had very few last year, the following season after the tornado. I thought, well, are they still scared of coming back to my area? Because I still have the same plants. They're even bigger and more prolific. But now I'm just wondering if it was due to the huge drop in the amount of monarchs in 2020. And so that leads me to how was the population in the fall or the winter of 2020?
In 2020, we were up from 2019.
Okay.
But what they realize, and this has just come to light in the last 3 or 4 years, the significance of the spring weather in Texas. And if we have a warm March and we have a lot of growth of plants and specifically milkweed, the warm temperatures help the monarchs go through their life cycle faster. And there are more butterflies to go north because typically a female will lay 100 to 400 eggs, of which about 4% become butterflies. So, you know, she's not a very successful producer. She produces eggs. The eggs are left to fight on their own. There is no mothering instinct in monarchs. Their job is to lay all their eggs, and then they die. And but the more eggs that can be laid in Texas, so it's really good if Texas is warm and Oklahoma and further north stays cool, because that keeps the monarchs here, where there, in a typical year, there is ample milkweed for them to have to produce a lot of offspring and make that first northbound generation very populous.
That makes sense.
And of course, that's not going to happen this year because the milkweed was stopped in its growth by the freeze. And now the monarchs have outflown the growth of the milkweeds. They got too far north too soon. And there's no milkweed. So we know already we're off to a bad start.
Oh, Janet.
I know. It's really sad, but, you know, this, the...
So where are they going to come from, Janet? Give me some hope.
Well, what we can do is each of us can, we can plant some milkweed. We can surely plant nectar plants. Mm-hmm. And most of the ones that I have that are normally producing flowers this time of the year are not. You know, the only ones, like autumn sage, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's a great plant for the hummingbirds and the butterflies. And in a normal year, it's blooming in mid-March. Mm-hmm. Well, this year it wasn't. Only the ones, I have two that are blooming because I bought them last fall and they were still in their containers and I put them in the garage. So they survived.
Yeah.
Okay. But none of the ones that I have that were already in the ground have flowered out yet.
Yeah.
So you milkweed know, and nectar producing plants, is there anything else that people can be doing to help the monarchs?
That's kind of it, because unlike the hummingbirds, which are having the same problem, is there's not enough flowers for them to drink their nectar, and there's not enough insects, because they think all the insects were killed in the big freeze. And hummingbirds live on nectar and insects. They drink the nectar to get the energy to catch the insects, which are the protein. And so they're having a hard time as well. But, you know, just be aware that the best thing you can do is to plant native plants and create in your own property a bloom that lasts from March until November when it freezes, you know, by having a succession of bloomers in many cases, and really provide, it's especially important to provide in the early spring and in the fall. And most of us have flowers that are blooming in the summer, but to make a real effort to get the early bloomers out and the late bloomers, or the ones that will bloom all the way till November, because the monarchs usually come here, their most frequent arrival is the third week of October, but it varies by the weather conditions. And the truth of the matter is, more of them go west of here than come through here. So they're kind of on a Wichita Falls, Abilene. That flight pattern would attract more than the one that includes the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Okay, that's interesting.
We're on the fringe of their flight pattern.
Y'all take a deep breath, absorb what Janet just said, and go plant milkweed. Early bloomers and late bloomers is what it comes down to.
And especially natives, lot of the hybrid plants that you find in your nurseries and garden centers and big box stores might not produce nectar. Some of them do, but a lot of them don't. Because they don't have to attract pollinators, because they're not created through a nature-made process. They're propagated from cuttings.
Thank you for that distinction.
So they don't produce seeds, so they don't need to attract pollinators.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, I have one quick question before I ask the final question. Just one more quick question.
I told you, Janet, she wasn't going to let you go.
Have you heard how the monarch populations are doing in other parts of the world, such as South America, Australia, New Zealand?
No, I haven't, because most of the information that comes to me is predominantly U.S.-based.
Okay.
With some from Mexico and some from Canada. I'm on a mailing list that includes some people in New Zealand, but that's a whole different population of monarchs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she pipes in every couple months with something, but we don't really... what I have available, what comes to me, is just North American.
Okay. Well, I hope the other populations and around the world are doing better than the North American ones. But
I hope our fellow Kiwis are doing a better job than we are.
Yes, most definitely.
Well, in many things they do.
They do.
You know.
Janet, my husband is from New Zealand, so we have this conversation often in my home.
I bet. Well, I knew you were married there because I remember when your mom was going to your wedding.
Yes.
So, Jan, are we ready?
Okay, Mom, your final question.
Okay, we come to the final question that we ask everyone. And Janet, what do you think is the most important thing each individual can do to help reverse global warming and climate change?
Oh, wow. That's a toughie. Well, since I'm a big native plant person, and I admit I am anti-lawn, I would say get rid of your lawn, plant native plants, and that's not only beneficial for all the animals and the ecology, but it would so much reduce the amount of gas emissions, because lawnmowers produce so much more gas emission than cars do. And so, you know, you'd be replacing something that has symbolized American prosperity for centuries and replace it with something natural that would benefit the ecology. Is that going to change the climate? No, but it will benefit everybody that's here now and maybe have a small effect on the future.
I love that.
And by everybody, I mean all the animals, not just humans.
Janet, thank you so much. Before we let you go, are there any, you know, resources or tips that come to mind in terms of where people can go to learn more about monarchs? Are there any websites or organizations that are your favorite that you want to direct people towards?
One of my favorites has been for Journey North. And I've been looking at that for 15 years, probably. And it is now run by the University of Wisconsin at Madison at their Arboretum.
Okay.
It was formerly run by the Annenberg Foundation, but in the last few years, it's changed hands. But this is a great citizen scientist site, and it gives weekly updates on the migration of the monarchs and other animals. And they have maps where you can see where the animals have been sighted. It has lots of good information about monarchs and hummingbirds and other things. Another one specifically for the monarchs is Monarch Watch. And it is run out of the University of Kansas, which is probably the top research spot about monarchs at this time. But the Chip Taylor is the researcher there, and he has recently retired. And it's interesting. I'm sure that there's less going on in his life that allows him now to be a more of a contributor to Monarch Watch and another list that he has called the Deplex, which is anybody can join it, and you just get tons of emails about Monarchs. Awesome. It can be an overwhelming amount, but he's much more present on there since he's retired from his teaching job and research.
Amazing. Well, Janet, thank you again so much. We can't wait to spend time with you some more time on our bonus episode. For those of you who are with us on Patreon, we're going to go deeper into all of this Monarch love stuff and talk about how you can be part of the Citizen Scientists program. And Janet will talk to us more about that and what that's all about. But Janet, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This was a little heartbreaking, but we knew it was coming. But you really just enlightened me even more about the Monarch's life and how important it is to take care of them and easy steps that we can take in order to do that. So I thoroughly enjoyed your Monarch 101 time with us. Thank you.
It was fabulous. And thank you so much for your time and your expertise. Janet, you're a wealth of knowledge.
Well, I'm a wealth of love of the topic.
Aww, we love that. Well, thanks much, Janet.
Thank you.